So I ended the sitting a little bit early today because, unfortunately, I have to leave early today. I can't stay until 7. And maybe that's okay if I leave you here at some point. My main academic advisor at Stanford asked me to come and teach his class this evening, a mindfulness practice. So the class starts at 7. So I need to leave a little bit before to get over there. I wanted to read a quote from the Zen Master Dogen, which I thought is kind of remarkable. Dogen says, "Students," so he's talking to all of us, "do not practice Buddha Dharma, do not practice the Dharma for your own sake. Do not practice the Dharma for name and gain. Do not practice Dharma, the Buddha Dharma, to attain blissful rewards. Do not practice Buddha Dharma to attain miraculous effects." Practice the Buddha Dharma solely for the sake of the Buddha Dharma. So do not practice the Dharma for your own sake, but practice the Dharma for the sake of the Dharma, is how I read this passage. And there's often a distinction that's made, I think, in almost all religious traditions between something or other that looks like being self-centered or egotistical and something which is something other than that, which is the opposite, perhaps, of being self-centered or egotistical. So the question is, what is that larger reality or the larger interactive reality that we live in that we might consider to be larger than any kind of small sense of self or individualistic sense of self or separate, independent sense of self that gets us into trouble because we're constantly defending it or protecting it or asserting it in ways that perpetuates both separation and alienation and perpetuate clinging and holding and suffering itself. And to have a sense of letting go of that small sense of self or whatever it is to find some other way of being in the world which feels very qualitatively quite different. And then religious people like to come up with metaphysics to describe what that's like. And there can be many descriptions, and each person will come up with their own language. But there seems to be something, some kind of context or sense of presence or sense of being in the world, interconnected with the world, that seems to be some people would say not so personal, not so separate from everything else, not so individualistic. There's many different ways of saying it. And for me, taking refuge, and also taking the precepts, but both of them, especially taking refuge, is for me very much relaxing or trusting myself, entrusting myself into this larger sense of reality. Who I am, it's who I am. But it isn't my narrow sense of self-identification. It isn't kind of the narrow thoughts and ideas I can have about who I am. But rather, it seems almost as if, and sometimes it's a sense the boundaries of, you know, the normal personal boundaries tend to dissolve into some kind of... When I first was practicing at the San Francisco Zen Center, I had a kind of a practice discussion with one of the teachers up there. I guess asking about... I forget exactly what I was asking about self or no self or whatever. And he explained that there were two... in relationship to the self, there were two religious paths you can take. And one was kind of via negativa, which is kind of path of denial, path of saying no, path of finding there's no self. And it's often, anyway, just you find there's no self. You kind of see this is not self, and this is not self, this is not self. And finally you realize there is no self. And then you relax. And you have a profound level of trust can arise when you realize there's nothing to defend. And then that's nice. The other path is a path that affirms the self in a sense, but the path is to expand and enlarge the self and see that you start with yourself and then you expand your identity ever outwards until you realize that you are inseparable from the whole universe, that you are the whole universe, and that's your identity. And when you realize that, there's no separation anymore, then you relax. Then you can trust. And so he was saying that the two are just two different paths of coming to the same place. And perhaps that is. There's this famous quote in the Vipassana world. Some of you maybe can help me remember it, but I think it's from Hindu teacher named Nisargadatt. Wisdom tells me that I'm nothing, and love tells me that I'm everything. And my life swings back and forth between the two. So I think for me, to take refuge is to choose to move from, to act from, to live from, or to move away from a more strictly self-centered viewpoint in life to one that maybe is larger-centered or other-centered. Or I don't want to, I'm just kind of throwing out something vague here to you. I hope you get the general sense of what I'm saying, because I'd like to hear from you how you would word this for yourself. But you see the difference between that taking refuge is take refuge in a larger context, at least, than yourself, your individualistic sense of self, or whatever that is, that problematic self. If I say that, then there's no problems, right? No one wants the problematic sense of self. And so what I'm curious to hear from you is what you think that might be for you. What do you have sense as a larger sense? Or this dichotomy. Yeah? Is this some kind of dichotomy like this? Is this relevant for you in the context of taking refuge?
Can you repeat the question?
The question is, if we understand taking refuge to mean taking refuge or entrusting ourselves or trusting ourselves into another perspective, viewpoint, another sense of reality that is larger or bigger than a normal self-centered sense of self, what is that larger sense of self, or that larger sense of reality that we entrust ourselves to? Does that make sense?
The world of energy.
Energy, yeah. So that's something you can trust?
I can learn to trust.
Uh-huh.
When I first started to get involved in spiritual matters, my teacher spoke about a higher self, which was a name I called for part of me that I came to know. Very wise,
mm-hmm.
No ego. never argued. I mean, it actually was a different voice, but I heard,
mm-hmm.
I meditated. But it was like an entity that I always trusted. It was always there,
mm-hmm.
and it was always wise.
Yes.
Maybe that's
mm-hmm. right. Great.
Recently, I can't say how I came to that point. I know it took a lot of daily meditation walks. I came to a place where I became somehow very open, and I felt almost like my heart simply opened. I sort of dropped defenses, and what came to me was simply that I was being nourished by the world.
Mm-hmm.
Everything that came to me
uh-huh.
was timely and appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no sense of being alone, because I felt connected to everything that
uh-huh.
came my way. And I didn't need a sense of having to plan.
Uh-huh.
It was really clear that it was sufficient to simply respond in the moment to what life presented me with.
So it sounds like in part is a trusting a connectedness, and that if you're connected to the connectedness, that
it takes care of itself.
Somehow things take care of themselves. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yes?
I think it's a closely human thing for me, that as I get to know myself better, I really see so much more clearly than every other human being, possibly animal and plant, for that matter, are the same. We all require the same things.
Mm-hmm.
That there is no difference. As eccentric as I am no different. And as strange as the behavior of people in the world can be, it is not foreign to me. As I really see myself in a way that can only be seen in meditation, I believe, by sitting long enough, quietly enough. And this stretches me out in a reciprocity with the world, an identity with it. And I work with plants and trees a lot, and I increasingly feel it with them too, and a consciousness in them, and in the dirt, in the rocks, in the water, in the air. So it becomes almost molecular. But first is that sort of character thing. What we all need to thrive is exactly the same.
When I first started my Zen practice, one of the questions I had from my teachers was worded something like this. It's pretty clear to me how I'm different from the floor or the wall or the trees or the plants, but I'd like to know how am I the same? That's the question. So part of this question also is referring to this quote by Dogen. You know, we don't practice the Dharma for the sake of ourselves, we practice it for the sake of the Dharma. What does that mean for you? I mean, these are kind of code words, right? Or how do you fill in the words so they have meaning for you? Does that expression have meaning for you? Not practicing for the sake of oneself, but practicing for the sake of the Dharma. Beyond you?
I suppose I don't really have a good enough sense to know what the Dharma is to feel like I'm doing anything for it.
For the sake of. I don't know if it's doing for. Yeah, for the sake of. Maybe it's another way of saying it. I don't mean it's like you're for the benefit of the Dharma, but rather for. What's another way of saying that? For the. Sorry?
In honor of?
No, just a little. Not kind of honor of, just.
It's an end, not a means. That's what I see.
It's an end, not a means.
It's not a self-improvement program.
Yes.
It just is.
Uh-huh. That's nice. I like that. Uh-huh.
So if you practice because the Dharma is there?
Yeah. You practice because of the Dharma. You practice the Dharma. The Dharma is what calls us to practice. We're not practicing in order to attain something for ourselves, but rather we're practicing the Dharma because that's what our nature is, maybe.
To perpetuate.
Our higher.
To perpetuate the Dharma is, I mean, certainly a lot of people are motivated by that, to perpetuate the Dharma. And I would if someone said that, I never want to take that away from them. I think it's a beautiful thing. But the sense of that is, that I often, when I hear it that way, is to perpetuate the Dharma, usually as a thing, like the teachings or the practices, it has kind of a narrowing focus. Rather, the Dharma that I think, when you practice for the sake of the Dharma, or the motivation comes out of the Dharma itself, it's you know, something like it's the nature of reality itself. It's you practice for the sake of reality. You practice for the sake of truth. You practice for the sake of just being alive, in a sense.
For the sake of your higher self, which is universal.
Ah, you could say that. There's many ways of approaching this, and I'm offering you a chance to kind of fill in the with your translation of this. Yes, Bill.
I think I started many, many years ago with a fascination for not just life and nature, but everything, like the sciences and studying that and looking at it and realizing on an intellectual level the interconnectedness of everything. And I think for me that is sort of the corner of the Dharma that I come to, not to understand it intellectually, because I certainly do that already. But there are two kinds of understanding for me. There's an understanding of the mind, and then there's a deeper understanding that comes sometimes that I sense. just the edge of, which is for me a true understanding. It's an understanding, a deeper understanding, which rings of truth and occasionally will bring a falseness to things that I've learned intellectually, and occasionally, or most often, will enhance them. And I set to enhance that, to bring that deeper understanding of everything and how it fits together and how I'm a part of it, which is the thing I understand the least. It is very easy to look outside of myself and see the motivations and actions of other people and the motivations and actions of plants and animals and the motivation and actions of planets and forces of nature, and all of these things come to me. But to understand on a fundamental level my connection to these things is a very, very hard thing. And I think maybe for me, at some level, that is the focus of my life. That is why I'm alive. Uh-huh. If you're looking for, there needs to be, if you need to have a reason, then that's, that understanding is why.
And that's beautiful. And I'm wondering, because you said you put focus on knowing, understanding the connection, I think. And I was wondering about the, for me, I like very much the word trust. So I don't know if it's, sometimes I wonder if it's a matter of knowing the connection as it is trusting the connection.
There is this deeper knowing that is not, knowing is an intellectual thing. Mm-hmm. No words and letters and pictures and books.
Uh-huh.
And go and learn concepts from teachers. That is knowledge, and you know that. There's something deeper in that.
Uh-huh.
Where you feel something where it becomes a mm-hmm. part of you.
So then different words are kind of all, can be almost synonyms for, or different angles just to me talk about it. And I often like to use the word trust myself. But no one else has to use the word. But knowing, trusting. There would be, you know, biblical meaning of knowing, you know, is kind of means to be intimate.
I don't particularly like the word trust, because once you know something, you need... Trust implies that there is on the other side of trust, you trust someone despite what might be done to you,
uh-huh.
despite some mirror of fear. And I think once you know life that, on the level that I feel that is necessary, then there's no need for trust. Uh-huh. It just is.
So the trust is so profound, you don't need trust anymore. Yeah, I understand. It's nice. Thank you.
This whole idea I responded to very, very sharply, because in two other things that I do, there is also a feeling of loss of self in the process of doing them. One is writing, that I am not entirely doing the writing, it is something passing through me, and the other is healing and medicine. And again, it is not entirely within my control, it is something which, as Native people say, you are a hollow tube. And I think the Dharma may be the same.
Mm-hmm.
You are a vehicle for these things in life, more than a single self. And that it is the process of the Dharma working itself out in human life and perhaps on other levels, and participate in that.
Mm-hmm.
So artists look so, you know, so self-centered. But they're not really. They're sitting there listening to the world.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully this is passing through them and something else. And in healing, if you don't have that, you can't heal. It's not your powers. So maybe the Dharma, the same way, passes through all of us.
Mm-hmm. So there are many definitions of Dharma, as we know. And sometimes, you know, the most common one is that this is just the teachings of the Buddha. And it's kind of the philosophy of the Buddha, the teachings, whatever he had to say. But, you know, there's more profound meanings of it. And one common one you find is it's truth. It's what's true. It's the truth itself. And what is truth? You know, it's sometimes it has almost a metaphysical quality to it. And there's also... But a definition of the Dharma that I like is... the reality we confront, the reality we meet or find ourselves in, when it's unobstructed by our greed and our hate and our delusion. That's the Dharma. The world that we meet that, you know, is entangled with our greed, hate and delusion, that's kind of colored by that, is not the Dharma. But the world itself, our experience of the world, our presence in the world, unobstructed by greed, hate and delusion, that's the Dharma. And when it's unobstructed by greed, hate, and delusion, I think there's a kind of connectedness that happens, and reciprocity or a interactive kind of mode that happens that is kind of mysterious, and it lends itself to great metaphysical speculations and claims about the nature of reality. Partly because we don't necessarily see all the times the causal nexus, the pathways of these kinds of connections. Yes.
Last week you said we should think about one of the precepts of don't take what's not there. And for me, it sort of ties into what you were saying. What happened to me with a snake, I was gardening, and there was a snake there. And immediately I was filled, I brought to that situation fear, and I jumped back, and I was very upset about it all. And I went and got my husband, and he came down, and he realized the snake was caught in a webbing that was in the garden. And I thought it was a rabbit, for sure. But he got its tail out and saw it wasn't a rabbit, and it was a huge gopher snake. It was like 4 feet long. And I'm sitting there, I'm very shaken by the whole thing. And he tenderly picks up the snake and carefully cut away the webbing. The snake surely would have died if he hadn't gotten him out of this net. And what he brought to it was just love and compassion for the snake, and he just set the snake free. And it's just been with me what I bring to the situation. Mm-hmm. I brought the hatred and the aversion to the snake, and he brought just innocence, just love, just compassion for the snake. So it was that facet of looking at the precept I just found really fascinating to see. What I'm bringing all the time that isn't there. The purity of the Dharma, I guess, or the purity of what's happening.
Beautiful. Other reflections like that on from last week, the assignment from last week. It's all connected, I think.
Truly awake, the past and the future in the present meet.
When I went to Japan to practice there, I think probably many of you have heard this story. I went without very little money. I was given the airplane ticket there, and I showed up and didn't have much money. So I thought, well, I have to kind of find some way of having a livelihood, of supporting myself. So I went to work setting up opportunities to teach English. It's what many Westerners did there, taught English. And within a few days or a week or so, I had a number of teaching jobs lined up. And they were going to start in 10 days or something. It was a gap before they actually started. So I thought, well, you know, what does a Zen priest do? Well, you know, in Japan waiting for work, so I went to a local Zen monastery to sit sesshin. And during sitting sesshin, the Zen retreat, as the retreat came to the end, it was dawning on me that I had to go back to Kyoto and start teaching English. And it didn't sit well with me, and I felt, you know, I came to Japan in order to practice, not to teach English. And so it kind of, the sense of agitation or conflict rose more and more, until finally, near the end, I think the last day of the retreat, I decided, well, come what may, I came here to practice. I'm going to throw myself into the world of practice and just somehow trust that it's going to work, even without my money. And so I did, and I threw myself into the world of Zen practice in Japan. I did that for a year, and at the end of the year, I left Japan with more money than I came with. I mean, not by much, but you know, $50 more maybe. And because what happened was that as I practiced, threw myself into the world of practice, other people wanted to support me. The other people were supportive and honored that. And it wasn't necessarily personal use for me, it was just the fact that someone there was practicing and you want to support that. So I was given places to stay, I was given train fare, I was given actually money. And it was marvelous the way you were taken care of. And I think that, I believe that if when people practice, that somehow the world takes care of you. Or as it's said sometimes in Vipassana world, that those who protect the Dharma or those who entrust themselves in the Dharma are protected by the Dharma. And it's one of the meanings of taking refuge is to receive protection from the three treasures. And I don't know, you know, I believe it's true, and it's a little bit maybe superstitious for me to say that. But I think that, you know, as I said earlier, causal network of our lives, the way that cause and effect relationships happen are often very subtle. But, you know, if your practice, your tendency is to meet the world perhaps with a little bit more compassion than you normally would, a little bit more openness or friendliness. And if you do that, people you encounter respond to that. The snakes you encounter respond to that, perhaps. And so there's a response there, and that response tends to be beneficial, more likely than not. And so the accumulation of this kinds of stuff will mean that people somehow will respond positively in ways that support and are helpful. And so you can call it a protection, you can call it whatever, interactive relationship. But again, the number of ways, the ways this happens are so convoluted or so complicated at times that we really don't know why it's happening or how it's happening. And so since it's such a complicated network of causality, then it's often easy then to kind of make larger metaphysical claims. You know, that God is protecting me or God's watching me or whatever. Yes.
I think something for me that goes right along with that is we can ask ourselves the question, how much of what happens, you know, I guess you could say to us, can you perceive as a gift? And sometimes you can really expand that. And it's like, you know, getting a livelihood or anything else, as you were talking about. You can have an unending stream of gifts.
Yes. Uh-huh. Just being able to breathe is a gift. And that's happening all the time. And so I think two ways this can work is that some people can take it on as a practice to see, or as an attitude, to see that everything is a gift. And we have powerful means of interpretation. And this wonderful means of interpretation we have mean that, you know, you can make everything into a gift. Even things... maybe some of you know, there's an expression in psychotherapy where... When the therapist makes an expression, when a therapist makes a mistake, the client will inevitably find it interpreted in a way that's useful for them. so that's, you know, that's one way. It's kind of just a fine. Take it on as a practice, and it's, you know, it can actually come quite alive. The other is that I think as we, you know, drop our greed, hate, and delusion, as we open ourselves more trustfully or more knowingly in deep way to the world, I think it's often natural to start feeling things feel much more gratitude for things that happen. You feel it's a gift. Those two things, but yeah. And thank you. Yeah.
Something that I noticed this week as I thought about this idea of not taking what isn't offered in a situation was actually a sense of relief a lot, because I think I put a lot of energy into trying to manipulate situations in my life for certain ends.
Uh-huh.
And just not to do that once in a while this week was a relief.
Mm.
I think it's a lot of work.
It's exhausting.
Yes.
Yes.
It seems as though practicing the Dharma with the expectation that good will come of it sounds awfully like practicing for oneself.
Yeah, for sure. That's a good point. And so we shouldn't practice because good will come from it, but even so, good will come from it. Right? You can see it as a byproduct.
I don't see why.
Why? Why good will come from it?
Why shouldn't just things happen in the ordinary way that happens to everybody?
Well, good is a strange word, I guess, because it has a value connotation. Less value connotation is the expression of being protected or being taken care of. Or so when I was in Japan, I entrusted myself in the world of practice. And what I needed in order to survive was provided to me. And that's kind of like, that's what happened. And now what the causal relationship is, I don't know. But that's what happened. And it's very easy then to kind of in a shorthand to say, well, that was a good thing that happened.
In life, however, one so often sees very wicked people rewarded by great good.
Yeah. But that's an interesting one. I believe that that's where the perspective, what we learn from ourselves in meditation, can change our view of that. I found in myself and many of the students that I've talked to that as we sit and become more honest with ourselves, or sit and kind of release the surface chatter of the mind and the deeper stuff can surface, that we discover to our surprise how much is buried there. And some of the things that are buried there are the unwholesome things we've done. And it's my firm belief, actually, but it's a belief, I can't know for sure, that anybody who does anything really unwholesome, really harmful to someone else, they've done something to themselves in that process. They've cut themselves off, they've alienated themselves from themselves, they've repressed certain sensitivity they have, the memory gets repressed, or something happens. And in the equation of the heart, and if they're able to keep themselves busy until the moment they die, maybe they never have to confront that. But it's there festering. But if those people just stop and just stop a little bit and stop running around, stop being so busy and start noticing, these things start surfacing. And many of us have had those experiences, and hopefully it's been small things. That you remember, and you remember things from 30 years ago, and you say, oh, and then you're motivated to give someone a call and try to make amends after 30 years. They've long since forgotten who you are. And but it can happen. So someone might have benefits in the short term, obvious kind of surface terms, but I suspect that it's a tremendous cost to their heart or to their inner life that's been shut down or cut off. They could get wealthy. They can get all kinds of wonderful superficial things, but the heart gets cut off.
I think we can rest very securely in our delusions.
Meaning what?
That when people have very strong belief or faith that they can do things which don't at all recognize other realities, other people's realities,
yeah,
but they feel very firm and comfortable in their ability, yeah, to meddle in this way.
Oh, so people think they're doing tremendous good for the world. And actually, they're creating lots of harm, for example.
You're just acting out dharma.
But in a sense, I'd be careful how we use the word dharma.
Well,
a little bit.
As it offers
uh-huh.
itself to
uh-huh.
us. I think.
Uh-huh. Jonathan?
I think dharma is good to practice. It makes me happier, it makes people around me happier. Everyone's a little bit happier. It seems, not that I'm very good at it, but. It's a certain kind of, it's not a self-help program. Well, hey, it works. Why not?
I think
so. I see no harm in thing as something like a self-help program, but there's something a little deeper than a self-help program. And I don't see why that's not a great motivation to practice.
I think it's a fine motivation to practice, and I wouldn't want to take that away from anyone. And I guess you're sensitive to the fact that the implication would be, since we're trying to talk from another point of view, that point of view may be something wrong with. But it's a beautiful point of view. It can be a dead end if you're stuck in that place. If you're only practicing for yourself, at some point you'll come to dead end. And what people will do at some point, they'll benefit from the Dharma to a certain point. And then they either find some other way of practicing that's not for their own benefit, or they'll stop practicing. And a lot of people will find a lot of benefit from practice, and then come to a point where they've gotten what they want. Now they want to go out and receive the fruits of that in their life.
Yes, my guess is that when you come to that sort of pursuing with the Dharma again, perhaps at a deeper level, you're still benefiting and you're still achieving a greater level of perhaps happiness and contentment in the world. Although superficially you may be losing out on that, whatever it might be.
Oh, in that sense, yeah.
But, I still think that the underlying motivation for me, no matter how far I would go, my guess is that it would always be for greater happiness, and that part of my being happy would be others being happy.
Beautiful.
Things would fuse together a bit more.
Well, I think that's an example of the motivation, in a sense, becoming greater than just yourself. You're not practicing directly for yourself, perhaps, but you're practicing. At some point, you realize that your happiness is connected to everyone else's happiness. And so when you encounter suffering, you are practicing because of that encounter. You're not practicing, pulling yourself away from that in order to feel good again. But that becomes the motivation for your practice. And that kind of puts a little bit in context the Bodhisattva ideal in Mahayana Buddhism, where the ideal is to practice for all sentient beings. And you're going to practice basically until, the classic thing is, until everyone else is enlightened first. And without getting into that too much, I understand that, at some point, your practice becomes inseparable from the practice of everybody. Mm-hmm. And practice then is forever. You never can imagine an end to practice, because it's not necessarily for yourself anymore, but it's there's for those 4 billion people out there and the other beings. There is the example of... There's a sect of Japanese Buddhism here in America that whose primary practice is chanting. And they recruit a lot of people, especially from lower income brackets, by promising they can get anything they want if they chant, the sacred chant. And all you have to do is wish for it. So you wish and you chant for your Cadillac, for your job, for a spouse, for a new mortgage and a house, whatever you want. And a lot of people come and join them. And a lot of people join them and find that actually things start happening for them in their life. What they want actually starts happening. And they feel really good and happy. And when people who, like other Buddhists, go to some of the leaders of that sect and say, what's going on here? It seems a bit funny to be self-serving, You want a better Cadillac, or I guess Cadillac's old-fashioned these days, but, a better Lexus. What their answer is, yes, it is, but in the short term, you need to take care of the people's material needs and their kind of basic needs, and if they get those things met, then they'll be ready to meet the deeper Dharma later. Which is kind of what you were saying, but in a little bit more dramatic terms. You're practicing for your own sake, for your own happiness, and for the things that you want, but at some point, you realize there's something deeper than that.
It's a self-correcting kind of device, which I sort of have faith in inside all of it.
Yeah. I believe, as long as you're practicing, yeah. Practice is, trust that. Or the example of the Aikido teacher who offered to teach some teenager how to kill effectively. And so after 2 or 3 years of Aikido practice, the kid didn't want to kill anymore. Because, Aikido is kind of like a meditation. And that's what he had in mind, the teacher, when he started the program. Bill.
Talking about good actions with people and bad actions with people and good things happening and bad things happening. For me, I have never met a person that didn't have some good qualities. I have never seen in action did not have its opposite consequences. In other words, something that was done out of what was supposed to be pure good always has some negative ramifications. What for me about people and actions and almost everything is that it is wondrous and miraculous. It is a wonderful thing to behold. And to say that they're good or bad are things, they just are. And to judge life by saying that some people do bad things and get good out of them, I wonder sometimes if those people see life. Maybe the whole thing of all of this is removing the veil and seeing life as it is, and that's all that's necessary.
I think that's very wise, what you said, and the veil that we learn to remove through Vipassana practice is often the veil of concepts, and good and bad are extremely abstract concepts, and especially good and bad people. I mean, that's like about as abstract as you can get, and if you can see actions or activities or intentions of particular things in the larger miraculous whole of a person or of an interaction, then we tend not to see people simplistically in ways that alienate. I think to see people as good or bad creates separation, alienation, even if you see someone as good, because you're not really seeing the person that's greater than any kind of thing. And so I think that's what you're saying, right? I think it's very important. So there's a quote that I was going to read on Monday when I talked about right speech. And when something like... I forget exactly, but something like a son came home to their father and complained about another boy at school who was a liar, and his father reprimanded the son for saying, you know, if you call him a liar, you're kind of cutting him off, that person, or you're kind of putting him into a category of who the person really isn't. Rather, you can say the person lied. There was the activity of lying. But don't color the whole person. Don't make the whole person. Don't give the whole that person that identity. And you know, we get so caught in concepts of identity for ourselves and for others that the attitude you're suggesting is a way of cutting through the veil of these abstract concepts that keep us from seeing actually what's happening. So the Dharma also, I think, for me means you know, things as they actually are occurring in our direct experience much more than what's occurring in our very abstract concepts of what's happening. And to being able to notice the difference between the abstractions and more closely what's happening more non-abstractly is a huge part of what Dharma practice is about. And so when we trust the Dharma, I think we're trusting in this experience of reality which is less abstract, less conceptual perhaps. Yes?
Perceptual or conceptual. I mean, I don't think we have anything other than our faculties to.
Well, that's why I was careful how I worded this. I said less conceptual, less abstract. Okay. There's a range.
Yeah.
And to get into the metaphysics of whether there's pure perception without concepts is to get into metaphysics. It's to get into, you know, I mean, and philosophers have spent hundreds, thousands of years kind of arguing this point, and whether there is pure experience or not pure experience or whatever. Buddhism, especially early Buddhism, the teachings of the Pali Suttas, the Buddha never seemed to posit a pure experience, but rather he recognized that we live on a spectrum, and the spectrum can be up there in the world of apancha, is our famous word, the world of great abstractions that is completely unconnected with reality, perhaps, and that's one end of the spectrum. The other end of the spectrum is the imaginary pure perception, pure. And we find ourselves moving up and down that spectrum, and the point of practice is not necessarily to come to pure experience so much as it is to bring ourselves close in that direction, closer to it, close enough so that we can see clearly enough, so that we no longer add suffering to the world. you know, the kind of relational suffering that can happen. And you don't have to luckily we don't have to go back to pure experience in order to free ourselves from suffering. But you have to be able to come back away from being lost in concepts also. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I just want to, this last weekend when we did we laid on the floor and we watched someone else breathe and then you breathe with them. I was working with Gloria. She's a nurse and I'm a nurse. And right away, when it said, watch someone breathe, I was timing her respiration. I was looking at her skin color. I was doing my whole spiel of assessment. That's what I'm trained to do.
Right.
And it wasn't until you said, start to breathe for this person, that the whole paradigm shifted for me. Suddenly I was in a whole other place. And that was the confusion I had about the sense of perception. One part feels very objective, very standoffish, very, I'm watching.
Mm-hmm.
Another felt like I was participating.
Uh-huh.
And with those two, there was a little shift, and I felt it.
Uh-huh. So it could be the difference between suffering is not necessarily one or the other, but rather clearly recognizing this is what's actually happening in the present. So when you're all your habits of being with a breath from the hospital are coming into place, if you don't see that, then you're not really seeing the situation clearly. But if you see, I'm acting out of my old habits, then you have the opportunity to see your old habits and to see the situation as it is in a sense. And then there's not necessarily a problem anymore. Then it's the Dharma. I need to go in a couple of minutes. You came late. I have to go teach a class at Stanford at 7. And I'm obligated to go. What I was going to propose was that, you don't have to go. And it may be nice, for the teacher to disappear. So you can... And what I was going to propose is that you break into groups of three and have little discussions, continuing this discussion. I think many of the things we talked about now, I think are very significant and interesting. And if you can talk about it from your personal point of view, what resonated with you and what it makes sense for you, I think that would be a rich conversation. Or talk about the exercise we did last week about not taking what is not given. That's my proposal. Or you can just have a group discussion, all of you together, or you can go home. But my suggestion is you meet in groups of three until 7. Is that okay with you, or do you have other ideas?
Sounds great.
And next week, I'll give you the details for what's happening on the 1st, June 1st. And if anybody's not going to be here next week, then you should call me, I guess, because I need to tell you a few things. I need to get a list of who's actually going to be there. I need to know that beforehand. So I need to get all your names and all that on a piece of paper.
If you have missed a session,
that's okay.
It's okay.
And
so we can give you our names next week.
Yeah, I'll just pass a piece of paper out or something. But if you miss it, you have to call me so that I know that you're coming and tell you the little things you need to know. And I still haven't decided where. There's been two offerings of places to meet. And I'm going to go, I guess, sooner or later. It has to be sooner. Go see which one has the best, seems the best for us and has the best view of the moon and things like that. And I was driving over here for this class, and somehow it occurred to me the question or the exercise of, I was thinking about taking refuge in Sangha. What does that mean? And I was thinking about the situations where I've been in where I met someone where something they did reflected or stimulated some good quality. Can I still use the word good? Some good quality in myself, some wholesome quality in myself, which was either dormant or repressed or week or something. Or like once, you know, it's happened, you know, I'm in a funk, you know, I'm just kind of in a funk. And I go into some supermarket and the clerk's really upbeat. Yeah, how are you doing? You know, and suddenly my day has brightened up. It's just remarkable. You know, that clerk was, you know, the Sangha was, you know, was the inspirer for me. So that's one way. I mean, there's many ways of understanding Sangha, but it might be interesting if you, to do that as an exercise this next week, is to be sensitive to what other people do who are in your presence that seems to elicit, seems to awaken qualities about yourself that you appreciate or you find wholesome or makes you happier or whatever. Remember the first week we talked about finding qualities of the Buddha in other people? Maybe this is finding them in yourself, but with a nuance of how do other people help you to do that? Any last questions?
Do you have any handouts from last week? Because I was last week.
I guess I was given the extras.
No,
I took them home.
I'm talking about the chanting.
Everything. We had two handouts last week. We had the
I wasn't here last week and I'd like to have